sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today I'm joined on the show by author Andrew Craig, who used to write for the Hartford Courant. His first book, published in the 1980s, was called Spiked: How Chain Management Corrupted America's Oldest Newspaper. His most recent book and the topic of today's interview is Presidential Puppetry: Obama, Romney, and Their Masters. I picked up the book in Washington, D.C. at the 9/11 conference and met Andrew Craig at the same time. And here he is. Andrew Craig, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Cheryl. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about your background and your connection to Connecticut?
Well, I started my first job in the career force or workforce in 1970 for the Hartford Courant, right out of college. And I worked at the Courant as a reporter and Sunday magazine editor until 1984 with an interruption to go to Yale Law School.
Weren't you just visiting Yale recently?
Yes. My 30th reunion, class of 1983, occurred over the weekend, and it was a very memorable experience for many reasons, including the great education opportunities, but also seeing what had happened to various people. And one of them, who actually attended a decade before me, was Hillary Clinton, who gave the featured address of the weekend.
And is there anything about that you want to share? Or?
Yeah, I think so. She was quite eloquent and very well received, and I recommend a couple of articles about it, including on the Yale site and in the Courant. I have to say, in addition, though, and this is more in keeping with what I've been doing recently and the focus of your show, that as warm and fuzzy as it all is, there's much work still to be done, and it kind of struck me that I was feeling a little bit like the skunk at the garden party and thinking of not just the accomplishments of her and those who are there, but inconsistencies and continuing problems that our country faces.
Yeah, those things that the corporate media won't tell us about.
Well, exactly. In fact, just today I was reading an interesting essay by an author named William Bloom, and he mentions that omissions in the corporate media are a huge problem, and of course it's very hard for the public to understand what they are since they're omitted.
Right. Well, now, tell me, what motivated you to write the book Presidential Puppetry?
Recently, I've been running a legal reform group called the Justice Integrity Project, based in Washington, that takes a look at political prosecutions, actions of judges and prosecutors, and other omissions, including by the media, that lead to injustice. And after looking at a number of these situations, it seemed to me that there were factors occurring that could not be explained by law or other normal logic. And I had to look at the political background of the people who appointed judges and prosecutors, and it, in effect, became kind of a mystery that I felt I had to solve clue by clue, Cheryl. And essentially, it involved omissions in news accounts that help fill in pieces of the puzzle. So, to be a little more specific, one big matter was a great aberration of justice that occurred in Alabama in the federal prosecution during the Bush administration of the Democratic governor of Alabama, the former governor, Don Siegelman. And this was exposed in 2008 as a frame-up by the Bush administration and its Justice Department and Karl Rove. And I got to know a former Karl Rove ally and political operative named Jill Simpson, who worked on that case and decided that it was so wrong that she wanted to testify and blow open the injustice. And ultimately what happened is that nobody cared. Nobody did anything in power, that is. Actually, 113 former state attorney generals said that Siegelman did not commit a crime. And yet today, in 2013, he's serving a long prison sentence. So to wrap up this part of the story of why I wrote Presidential Puppetry, the mystery became not so much what the Bush administration had done, but why wouldn't the Obama administration rectify this Republican injustice against an innocent Democrat?
So Obama has done nothing to help out in this situation.
Well, in fact, they've argued at the U.S. Supreme Court that nobody should look into the case, and that Siegelman at every turn has been rebuffed by the Obama Justice Department, and he's now in prison for this 1999 series of events that, very specifically, the charge is corruption. But what he did was he asked one of the richest people in his state to contribute to a nonprofit, the Alabama Education Foundation, and then reappointed the donor to a board. And this happens all the time at every level of government, city councils, state legislatures, Congress, the presidency himself. And for this to be a 14-year prosecution is incredibly unjust.
You also go on in the book to talk about how there's a secret history to Obama and to most of our presidents that the corporate media doesn't cover. Could you tell us a little bit about Obama's secret history?
Yes. In 2009, just after he was inaugurated, I was watching the parade here in Washington, where I'm based, and thinking a whole new era was coming into play. Just a month later, a friend of mine who was a longtime Navy intelligence officer, Wayne Madsen, as a favor, I'd known him at the National Press Club, he took me to the National Archives and taught me how to look up easily declassified CIA documents. And in there, I saw a document that indicated that President Obama's first job out of college in 1983 was with Business International Corporation in New York, a research company. And the document suggested that this was a CIA front company. And that started me on years of research, because once you start thinking, wait a second, he worked from 83 to early 85 for a CIA front company, then you start going back into his history and forward into the community organizing time, and it puts a new light on it. And once you start looking for these clues to his behavior back then and what he's doing now, a pattern emerges that's quite different from the normal political dialogue. And this evidence that I found and put together in the book Presidential Puppetry is there for anyone to see. I documented it with 1,100 endnotes, so anybody else can follow what I did, including through hot links, including to that document. But the larger question about both President Obama and some of the other figures at the presidential level is, why doesn't anyone else pursue these leads? Why is it the web culture, the bloggers who have the time to go to the National Archive and stitch together clue by clue all of this information, which is right out there?
Now, you also made some connections that his family, his mother and even his father, his stepfather, had connections also to intelligence.
Well, again, once you start looking for these clues, they abound. One of the interesting things about his mother is very few people, even in the press, know much about her, even though there's been a couple books written about her. And, of course, she's mentioned in many articles as an anthropologist and so forth. But only a few in-depth researchers, including my friend Wayne Madsen, go into what it actually meant to be an anthropologist, both then and even now. And in fact, they had a very serious problem in the 1960s when his mother, Anne Dunham, was an anthropologist in Indonesia, because that was at a time of the Cold War and a lot of concern in academic anthropology circles that anthropologists were being recruited by intelligence agencies to work undercover, and that this was endangering particularly the ones who were not operatives, because they would go into remote areas and be suspected of working for the U.S. government. And in fact, in 1967, the head of the American Anthropology Association, Dr. Richard Beals, delivered a major paper to the anthropologists' convention on this topic, warning that recruitment of anthropologists was a huge problem exactly on this issue. Now, while he did not name Anne Dunham specifically, the overall situation points to involvement by both her and a number of other members of the Obama-Dunham family in these kinds of activities. And part of this has to do with the particular situation of Indonesia and Kenya, for that matter, as critical nations during the Cold War, where the U.S. really, really wanted to recruit the leaders of those countries and the key high-level members of society to the Western banner. And some of the listeners may remember the movie The Year of Living Dangerously, starring Mel Gibson and Sigourney Weaver, that was based in Indonesia at this time of the overthrow of the socialist national leader of Indonesia. And Anne Dunham came with her second husband and young Barry Obama into this environment, which was very dangerous, very politically charged. And while the conventional biographies simply point to her as a English teacher and anthropologist and very conventional activities, a lot was going on there when at least 500,000 people were being killed in a huge genocide that is almost totally ignored by conventional news accounts and biographies of our president.
Yeah, and didn't you say in the book also that one of Obama's earlier girlfriends, the Genevieve Cook, was also the daughter of an intelligence figure in, was it Australia?
Yes, that's a fascinating story, because until a prominent Washington Post biographer, David Marinus, discovered her, nobody knew about her. And Marinus wrote a quite lengthy and seemingly thorough book published a year ago about Barack Obama's early years. And one of the big discoveries, probably the biggest discovery of his book, was finding Genevieve Cook. And he mentioned briefly her father was Michael Cook, and he mentioned briefly that he was involved in intelligence in Australia. But Marinus, who's a great biographer, but also an important part of the conventional media, did not connect the dots to the other types of evidence out there. So he left it that the young Obama had a kind of doomed love affair with a white woman of high rank in society through her parents, who disappeared. But he didn't really explain that her father, Michael Cook, was head of a very important agency, the equivalent of the White House National Security Council, from 1981 to 89. And this is precisely the time that young Barack Obama was working at Business International Corporation for well over a year. The other thing about Genevieve Cook is she's kind of disappeared from view. She's not really available for interviews except to Marinus, who gave this kind of narrow, kind of romantic view of her, but without filling in the dots of the implications. And part of the implications are her stepfather was Philip Jessop, who also was very prominent in Indonesia, running a billion-dollar company during this period after Sukarno. And Philip Jessop was son of a quite prominent diplomat and extremely connected through the Council on Foreign Relations and so forth. So this is part of the web of early relationships that President Obama has that is virtually unknown to the public, and I think helps explain why there's so much misinformation and misunderstanding of him. He's a centrist who's far more Harvard Law School and Foundation and Wall Street than community organizer.
You also mentioned in the book, which I found interesting because I have thought this for quite a while, but I've never read it anywhere, and that was his connection with Bill Ayers, who was with the Weather Underground, and how you suggested that possibly Bill Ayers had been an agent, and I've often wondered that. I don't know if you could speak to that.
Well, I'd be glad to. Bill Ayers and his wife, Bernadine Dorn, were the notorious Weather Underground leaders who boasted of bombing and killing in the 1969 era and shortly afterwards, then went on the lam for 10 years and then resurfaced. And Ayers was able to go into university life and become kind of prominent in the foundation world in Chicago. And his wife served several months in jail, but then became an associate at a quite prominent Chicago law firm, Sidley and Austin, which is the law firm where Barack Obama met his wife, future wife, Michelle. And to get to your question, the question that's puzzled me and is how can these notorious bombers move into these prominent jobs without the kind of retribution that many other suspects have? Now, to cut through a lot of intervening steps here, it strikes me that at some point somebody had to say at Sidley and Austin, they're okay, they're working with us. And I don't have that nailed down totally, but part of the difficulty here is that people won't talk, records are lost or missing, but it's just not logical that a major law firm would hire a mad bomber without someone saying, she's working with us. Now, one thing I do point out in the book, though, is very interesting declassified correspondence and other evidence indicating that the CIA was highly active, as was the FBI, in recruiting radicals during the 60s. So while we don't have the stuff on Dorn and Ayers, we do know that the CIA had other SDS and left-wing people on the payroll and was funding, this is very amusing, was funding the Communist Daily Worker newspaper. So what this points to, just to get to the present and some of the implications here, is that national security, the FBI, the CIA, the other agencies basically want to recruit future leaders from all parts of the political spectrum, so that whoever wins, there's some connection with these people, so that the right type of thinking will have a chance from the perspective not simply of the CIA or FBI, but of the ultimate masters on Wall Street and at the defense community, the big energy companies, and so forth. And again, the concept here is presidential puppetry and puppet masters who are not necessarily at the CIA or FBI. Those are rotating jobs that go to the minions of the real puppet masters, and they rotate back to Wall Street or the big companies.
Now, in your book, Presidential Puppetry, you also mention how Reagan and Clinton had connections to the FBI and CIA. Could you talk about that?
Well, those are briefly mentioned partly because I'm citing other people. If people want the full detail, they can go to the other books. The one on Reagan is by Seth Rosenfeld. He published a book last year called Subversives, and it's based on 30 years of Freedom of Information Act litigation that he undertook to obtain records of Ronald Reagan. And he obtained something like 300,000 pages of documents, and basically shows that long before Ronald Reagan entered politics. He was an FBI informant in Hollywood, working with increasing activity with J. Edgar Hoover himself to help inform on those in the Hollywood community who were perceived as left-wing. And that as Reagan's career advanced, the FBI helped him as he became governor and had larger ambitions. Bill Clinton's relationships are less thoroughly documented, but they come from a number of sources that I cite. And the main one is that during his time trying to avoid the draft in 1969, there's very strong evidence from contemporaries that he was an informant for the FBI and CIA on anti-war radicals in England. Or maybe radicals is not quite the word, radicals and war protesters, as he was a war protester himself. But the record through these documents and through the statements of contemporaries is that the FBI in particular was very interested in recruiting informants to tell them what was going on, and in return they would grant help in avoiding the draft and getting delays. And in fact, Clinton did obtain some delays that helped prevent his induction. The link isn't totally clear that it was quid pro quo in return for help, but we know that the FBI was and CIA were helping others avoid the draft in return for information.
So in your book, you also talk about what really happened with General Petraeus and the events in Benghazi, and I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
Well, of course, very suddenly, we all remember how General Petraeus, who had moved on to become CIA director under the Obama administration, was suddenly outed immediately after last year's election as being involved in a sex scandal with his biographer, Paula Broadwell. And this was a big disgrace, and he was ousted, and it kind of blew over, and he's now on Wall Street as a hedge fund executive and teaching. I go back into the history to show that he was, at several junctures of his career under Obama, invited to run against his commander-in-chief, an act of stunning disloyalty to entertain such invitations, even though he ultimately didn't act on them. It also appears that Benghazi was a much more complicated story than the public has heard about, even though it's remained a major issue for the Republicans in the more than year since it occurred. Here's the real story of Benghazi. There's two main elements. One is Benghazi was a recruitment operation by the United States for arms from that region to be shipped to the Syrian rebels with the help of the CIA, which had a major installation there. Fighters were also being recruited to be sent mostly through Turkey to help the rebels overthrow Assad. This is all totally secret, in violation of our official policy of more or less standing on the sidelines and hoping that Assad would leave at the time. So you've got that in the background. You've also got an operation by the Republicans to embarrass Obama just before the election by having outbreaks of violence in the Mideast to show that his foreign policies weren't really working. And that obviously came together in Benghazi with the death of four of our personnel, including the ambassador. Now, the Republicans didn't really get what they wanted out of this, but they did keep up the complaints and try to blame Obama and Hillary Clinton and Susan Rice for the cutbacks in security. But there's a much deeper story there that neither party really wants to get into because it makes both of them look much worse. And ultimately, President Obama found out about this, and Petraeus's dubious role either working himself with Republicans or permitting some of his staff to work with Republicans. And in my view, the evidence points to the sex scandal is more or less a public relations excuse to get rid of a disloyal thorn in the administration's side, but to do it in a very public way that would attempt to disgrace him when they could have easily gotten rid of him without making a big stink about it in this way.
So you're saying or suggesting that it was a staged event, the Benghazi, where the killing of the ambassador and stuff was a staged event by the Romney people to discredit Obama?
No, I wouldn't go that far. I believe that they put in motion a scenario where any incident that might be created, they put in place a group of former Special Forces veterans, kind of like the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, Hammered Kerry. They had in place a group that would rise up and denounce Obama if anything bad happened in the Mideast. And this video that's never really been explained how that came about was part of this. But precisely why and how the raid occurred is still somewhat open, but the Republicans have totally discounted the video. I don't think you can discount the video that did create riots elsewhere in the region.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the video?
Well, an individual, a kind of marginal figure in Hollywood, hired actors to portray, under false pretenses, the desecration of the Prophet Muhammad and to portray him as a pervert. Now, these actors, some of whom were from the porn industry, dressed up in kind of goofy costumes and were not told what the plan was, and words were dubbed into the video, and it was released during the summer, and suddenly it got an infusion of publicity shortly before the election and prompted riots in some Arab countries. And the individual who made it was promptly arrested, sentenced to prison, but he's never really been interviewed and forced to explain why he did this, except in the most general terms. And what I've done in the book is trace this to a kind of Swift Boat Veterans for Truth type of group that I mentioned a few moments ago that has connections with the Karl Rove political hit operations.
You've just been listening to the first part of an interview with author Andrew Craig. His new book, Presidential Puppetry, was just recently released. His website is www.presidentialpuppetry.com. Tune in next week to hear the second and final part of that interview. Beginning this week, 9/11 Wake Up Call will also be aired on Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m. on WWUH. My shows are archived at radioforall.net. And that's the digit four, so radioforall.net. And some of the earlier shows from 2008 and 2009 are archived on the great website ct911truth.org. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.